This is the Reading Envy Podcast, where we'll have what you're reading. Hello, and welcome to the ice-covered back corner of the Reading Envy Pub.
Hi, Scott.
Hi, Jenny. How are you?
Oh, I'm freezing. Oh, so much ice.
Oh, nice. Yes, it's very cold. Who'd you bring with you today?
Today, I flew overseas to bring back our friend Luke Burridge. Hi, Luke.
Hiya. What do you mean back? This is my first time on this podcast. We have been on podcasts together before, though, many, many times. The three
yes,
of us.
It's true. Yeah. I just meant I brought you back from Germany.
UK. Well, yes, it was a long flight, but, it's very cold in Berlin. It's freezing temperatures here at the moment. I've had to get up my winter boots to get around in Berlin now.
And goodness. Me too. Mm-hmm. Well, all right. Well, let's talk about some books.
I guess
I'm first.
All right.
The first one I want to talk about is a book that Brian Alexander recommended to me. Back in episode 3, I talked about a book called The Crying of Lot 49, which perplexed me heavily. Postmodern, and I asked Brian Alexander, I said, well, so what are some other examples of postmodern books? And he recommended this one. It's called The Things They Carried by Tim O'Brien. This one did not perplex me. I thought it was very cool. In fact, I actually wrote Brian and I said, is this really postmodern? Because I didn't feel the things that I felt when I was reading that Lot 49 book. But as I went on in this book, which really is a collection of short stories, they're war stories, obviously, about Vietnam. Tim O'Brien is a veteran. And as I went on, I realized that the book was not only about the war and very poignantly about the war, and the stories are really affecting. But it was also about stories. So I'm going to, just rather than babble on, I'm going to read a paragraph to try to illustrate my point, and then I'll talk some more about it. But this paragraph is from a story called How to Tell a True War Story. He says, in any war story, but especially a true one, it's difficult to separate what happened from what seemed to happen. What seems to happen becomes its own happening and has to be told that way. The angles of vision are skewed. When a booby trap explodes, you close your eyes and duck and float outside yourself. When a guy dies, like Kurt Lemon, you look away and then look back for a moment and then look away again. The pictures get jumbled. You tend to miss a lot. And then afterward, when you go to tell about it, there is always that surreal seemingness which makes a story seem untrue, but which in fact represents the hard and exact truth as it seemed. So in a lot of the stories in the book, he says things like this. I can't remember how many stories started with, this is true. You know, those are the first line in the story. And then there's other times where he says, I'm 43 years old and this is true and I'm a writer now. And a long time ago I did this. All the stories kind of open that way. But then every now and then he just pulls away and he talks about what truth is and what seemingness is and how the story is important. It has a truth of its own, even if it's not 100% true. Am I making any sense whatsoever? I think that's what makes it postmodern, right?
Self-referential
truth.
Well, possibly, and maybe relativism. Possibly a postmodern kind of a thought process. Let me read one more section that I felt was really important. This is from a story called, in fact, this is the entire story called Good Form. It's very, very, very short. It's time to be blunt. I'm 43 years old, true, and I'm a writer now. And a long time ago, I walked through the Quang Nghi province as a foot soldier. Almost everything else is invented. But it's not a game. It's a form. Right here, now, as I invent myself, I'm thinking of all I want to tell you about why this book is written as it is. For instance, I want to tell you this. 20 years ago, I watched a man die on a trail near the village of Mai Key. I did not kill him, but I was present, you see, and my presence was guilt enough. I remember his face, which was not a pretty face, because his jaw was in his throat, and I remember feeling the burden of responsibility and grief. I blamed myself, and rightly so, because I was present. But listen, even that story is made up. I want you to feel what I felt. I want you to know why story truth is truer sometimes than happening truth. Here is the happening truth. I was once a soldier. There were many bodies, real bodies with real faces. But I was young then and I was afraid to look. And now, 20 years later, I'm left with faceless responsibility and faceless grief. Here is the story truth. He was a slim, dead, almost dainty young man of about 20. He lay in the center of a red clay trail near the village of Mai Key. His jaw was in his throat. His one eye was shut, the other eye was a star-shaped hole. I killed him. What stories can do, I guess, is make things present. I can look at things I never looked at. I can attach faces to grief and love and pity and God. I can be brave. I can make myself feel again. Daddy, tell the truth, Kathleen can say. Did you ever kill anybody? And I can say, honestly, of course not. Or I can say, honestly, yes. And that's the whole story. So
That's really powerful. Because, again, you like you say, it's a story about war, but it's also a story about stories about war and a story about stories.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
Many layers there. I mean, it's very kind of, in a way, it's very blatant about what it's doing. Or, you know, Tim O'Brien, that character in that story is very blatant about what that character in that story is doing. But yet, it isn't. It's subtle and blatant at the same time, if you know what I mean. The different levels that you could be working at there.
Right.
Very
right.
Strange.
Yeah, and it makes you, it makes me think about, you know, truth and what the importance of truth is. When you watch the news or something, you know, what kind of truth are you getting? Does it matter? It makes you think all these kinds of thoughts. And again, I think that's what makes it postmodern, or why Brian would hold this up as an example of postmodernism. But this was a really special book. This is something that that I'm going to have to read again sometime. It's going to stay on the shelf. So I thank Brian for recommending it to me. But it has the layer of being as several stories about the war and about events in the war and the soldiers in the war, and then it has this deeper truth, you know, this poetic truth to it that really touches me deeply. Go ahead.
Was Tim O'Brien, was he a soldier himself, or is this just off out of his own mind? I don't know anything about this.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to say yes. I'm gonna have to say yes. The book was written in 1990. It says says it's semi-autobiographical, sharing some similarities. He has a memoir called If I Die in a Combat Zone, Box Me Up and Ship Me Home. The thing is, he says that he was a veteran and everything, and then he talks about things being true and not true. But I, as far as I know, he is a veteran of the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So do you think, I'm a person, like, in my fiction, I don't really like to read war literature. Do you think there's enough in it to interest me otherwise?
I think that, you know, because you love story so much, I think it would be very worth reading. Mm-hmm. It's not too graphic, although there are some very, very difficult things that happen.
Sure.
But I think it's very well worth reading. You know, it's, you know, you don't read a lot of war literature, but I think this is something, this one and something like The Killer Angels, I would hold up and say these are excellent.
So as a representative of what is this, your second or third towed it into postmodernist literature. Mm-hmm. What do you think of this compared to Gravity's Rainbow? Which was the other one that you said?
The Crying of Lot 49.
Oh, that was it.
Yeah,
okay, yes.
I really another loved this one. Yeah, I loved this one, and The Crying of Lot 49 to me was confusing, and I didn't quite understand it. only that, but I didn't feel strongly enough about it to say, well, I need to understand it. But I did talk about that in episode 3 at length, and it didn't connect with me at all. This one did from the very first.
So you think this one is it because it's more of a, it feels less of a intellectual experiment and more of an emotional storytelling experiment, but still, postmodern.
Yeah, I would have to say yes. Here I could read, 10 pages of this and come away feeling that I was with it. You know what I mean? In Lot 49, I could read 10 pages and say, what on earth did I just experience? I really honestly didn't understand it.
What, you felt like you were being experimented on or something like
possibly,
that?
Possibly. I felt like the author was kind of playing games, which might be fun. You know what I mean? I felt like, there was just so many things thrown in there. I remember thinking, so many different subjects. I felt that the author was really smart in Lot 49. That he was just throwing all kinds of things out there, but that I wasn't getting it all. And the narrative, I had difficulty with the narrative. Here, you could read a story and, you'd be with it the whole time. Hmm. So, that's important to me, I guess. But you're right. There was an emotional connection to this one.
I imagine there's wide spectrum of postmodern literature that you have yet to discover.
I'm sure. I'm sure. And Brian gave me a list. So it was in the comments. Anyone can see it. It's in the comments of episode 3. His
on
list.
The website. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. On the list of things that he gave me.
I remember now why I thought of Gravity's Rainbow. It's because that's now coming. It was just announced today that Gravity's Rainbow is coming out as an audiobook. There was a version recorded by, let me have a look here. I can't see it. Who it was recorded by? George Godall recorded a version in 1986 of Gravity's Rainbow, and then he's done a new one now. I guess updated with new technology recording.
And he's only just finished it.
From 1986 all the way through to 2014 to finish the recording of. I've never tried Gravity's Rainbow. I must admit, but it was
something like 37 hours.
Wow. I think it was it said 40 hours it was just a blog post that zipped by in my RSS reader today about that 40-hour audiobook, Gravity's Rainbow. Yeah. So maybe you can tackle that instead of reading it on paper, you can check it out on Audible.
Maybe that will be a goal.
Yeah. Get back to us in a year and a half.
Exactly.
Or get back to us in 22 years or however long, 28 years or however long it took for this one to come out.
Yeah, I just finished. Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, I love it. All right.
So, Luke, before you tell us about your first book, can you tell us a little bit more about yourself? Like, what kind of books do you like to read? I think most people in the universe know you from your podcast, but you read other books than that.
If people listening to this podcast know me at all, it will be, of course, from my science fiction book review podcast, or maybe from appearances with you and Scott and or Jesse on the SFF audio podcast is where people know me. So, yes, normally the kind of thing that I read and review is science fiction or sometimes fantasy or, that kind of weird stuff. And I talk about that on my podcast, the Science Fiction Book Review podcast. Sometimes my girlfriend comes on, Juliana, we talk about things together there, books that we read together. So that's the kind of thing that I normally do. However, outside of that science fiction, I do have lots of other interests and lots of other things that I'm interested in. And I was looking, thinking, well, okay, I don't, because you asked, hey, come along with two books with an extract to read out from two of the books or something like that. And I was thinking, well, I don't just want to review the book that I'm reading now. Like there's a few science fiction books that I'm reading now. I just finished up part one of Beggars in Spain by Nancy Kress. Mm-hmm. And so I was thinking, well, I'll do that, but I'm gonna do a podcast of my own about that anyway. And also I'm reading Ian M. Banks and, you know, the books that I've recently finished. I'm going to do reviews of those anyway. But so I thought I'd turn away from fiction and go to something else, which I find science fiction anyway, and turn away to something else, which I still find fascinating, but is still kind of literary. And that is the history of the writing and the development of the Bible. And instead of just that's a really big topic, though. So instead of doing that, I thought I'd pick out two books that I read recently. I say recently, I read these both last year and then this year, but I've recently gone back to them, and because it's history, you can go back in and read a chapter here or read some sections there if you want to kind of brush up on stuff. And so these two books are in my mind, and they're both about the first book that was written about Jesus, which is the Gospel of Mark. Even though in the Bible it goes Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, all the scholars agree, well, most scholars agree that Mark was the first one. Of the surviving literature that we have, of narrative literature about the character of Jesus, Mark is the first one. So is it okay if I dive into one of these books about this, the writing of this?
Yeah,
okay,
go ahead.
Do you want... I've got two of them here. Do you want something about Greek stuff or Roman stuff? Because there's these two books about it, and I thought this would be an interesting thing. So which one do you want first?
Probably start with the Greek stuff and then go on to the Roman stuff.
Okay, so let's go straight to Dennis R. MacDonald, The Homeric Epics and the Gospel of Mark. And that's his stuff. So I thought I'd do this because he has just released an updated version of this, which is not just about Mark. It's also about Mark and Luke. But the new book that he put out, because these are academic books printed by Yale University Press and what's the other one, Oxford University Press or something like that. When they first come out, they're quite expensive. But these ones you can pick up secondhand now for about $20 or something if you want to. So I would suggest starting off with this. And so I'm going to read a little bit about what Dennis R. MacDonald has to say. This is just from the introduction or the beginning of chapter one, and he's talking about why people copy other works, or like the process of copying other works, which is something that is transvaluation, which I'll explain here. And I'm going to skip through a few bits. I marked off some bits I want to read, so there's some gaps in between these quotes, but I put it together as a good introduction here. So he goes, I once bought my daughter a book entitled Sleeping Ugly, a hypertext of Sleeping Beauty that transvalued the fairy tale by replacing its patriarchy with a feminist perspective. Now I'm going to skip on to the next page. But Mark did not steal from the epics. He transvalued them by making Jesus more virtuous and powerful than Odysseus and Hector. Like Hector, Jesus dies at the end of the book. His corpse is rescued from his executioner, and he is mourned by three women. That happens to Hector as well. But unlike Hector, Jesus is raised from the dead. Mark may have cut his literary teeth on the epic, which also might explain a major incongruity in his composition. Despite its rustic, at times barbaric Greek, Mark's Gospel's literary achievement is brilliant. Some of Mark's brilliance, I submit, is Homeric radiation. I'll skip forward a bit more as well. Because of Homer's unrivaled hegemony in the ancient education, such imitations were common. Youngsters learned their ABCs, actually alpha, beta, gammas, by identifying them in epic poetry, and only after demonstrating facility with the Iliad and the Odyssey were they promoted to other books. Although it would be hyperbolic to call these epics a Bible for the Greeks, they did function as encyclopedias of religion, history, and culture. Even Plato, no friend of Homer, had to admit that this poet educated Greece. And then there's some statistics about stuff there. He goes, students in the ancient schools learned to write largely through mimesis, or its Latin equivalent, imitatio. Quintilian wrote to the teachers of other teachers of rhetoric. There can be no doubt that in the art, no small portion of our tasks lies in imitatio, since although invention came first and is all important, it is expedient to follow whatever has been invented with success. And so this book goes on to show how much of Mark is based in the Greek practice of mimesis or mimesis. There's different ways. I'm never actually quite sure when you read these terms and don't always hear audible discussions about it. I'm never quite sure of all these exact terms of this. But yeah, the idea is in this book, and argued very, very convincingly for most of the book by Dennis R. MacDonald, is that a lot of what we find in Mark has its roots in the Odyssey. And I know you, Jenny, were you part of the SFF audio reading group of the Odyssey reading group on there. Did you do? Did
no,
you join
I think
in
with
Scott
that one? Was though.
Yeah, I was. It was just Jesse and I that did the Odyssey.
Okay. Because yeah. I didn't listen to all of them because at the time I hadn't. I was kind of brushing up on the Odyssey, but I was again reading it from this other kind of point of view as well. Mm-hmm. But no, this book is really impressive. Pretty much all of the key elements, or a lot of the key elements in the life of Jesus as portrayed by Mark, you can find the roots. And it's again, the most important thing is it's not that he's just copying it. It's not that he's just like taking some of the language or the characters or the ideas. It's this transvaluation, which is the most important thing. If Odysseus did something in one way, Jesus would find himself in a similar situation, but then do an opposite thing, if that makes sense, or mm-hmm. take a different course. And I think this is a fascinating book. It's there's about maybe 200 pages of going through around about 100 different things that can be found in Mark that may like it may or may not be copied or like I say copied, but you know, transvaluated from the Odyssey and the Iliad. And I personally don't find all of them convincing. However, when you get 100 of them, even if 50 of them are convincing, that's still a really good hit rate. You have to do a lot of explaining to show that, no, these stories actually happened to a real person, and that real person really did these things and really said those things. And when you actually think, well, there's lots of mistakes, there's lots of continuity errors. How do we explain these continuity errors in Mark? It turns out when you actually look at those continuity errors in Mark and go, well, let's search for those same terms in the Odyssey, and you go across into the Odyssey or the Iliad and find those same terms there, the continuity errors and other incongruities they suddenly disappear. They are explained away. And like different events happening. Well, why did Jesus do that and then go and do this thing in a boat? And you're like, well, Odysseus, after Odysseus did that, then he went elsewhere in a boat. You know, then he did that same thing in a boat. You know, it's a very like interesting thing. It actually explains a lot of the weird stuff that's in the Bible. You go, what's going on here? What's this character doing? What's this character saying? What's this character saying? And of course, the theologians have their own ideas, and the people who think Jesus, all of the stories of Jesus is history, or there is some history of Jesus behind it, they have their ideas as well. Like, oh, this is actually history, and this can do this, and this means this. For me, it's a lot more clear to say it's a literary creation. And once you understand that, like you say, even though the writing is terrible, the storytelling and the imagery and why Mark's gospel, it was so popular at the time, is because of, like I say, it's Homeric radiation in a way. So that's my first show.
This concept, you call it transvaluing, is that what you said?
That's the term that Dennis R. MacDonald uses in this book. But yes, okay. This kind of stuff happens in literature all the time.
I was remembering we had a speaker. I went to a Quaker university, and we had a speaker named Walter Wink come in. I will never forget him because he stood on the stage and told us that we were all horrible people because we weren't living in communes. But there was a book that he wrote called Engaging the Powers, which takes all the stories in the Gospels and shows that concept of transvaluing. But I don't think he ever used the word, but he showed like how the expectation would have been that Jesus would have done this, but instead he did this other thing. And, you know, he had different conclusions because of it, but he definitely had gone through and made that same list. So it's really fascinating to me.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, who were the powerful figures in the time, in this case, in literature? Because this book was written, Mark was written as, it's a literary book, you know, it's not a novel, but it's certainly not history. The way it's written is very, it's kind of like, okay, there's this church teaching, and there's this character of Jesus who is already exists, people know who Jesus is, but who was Jesus? Like, what is the point of Jesus? And Mark made Jesus into someone who went against expectations. In any situation, he would go against the expectations that people would have had reading Homer. This is some of the statistics that it says. One catalog of manuscripts from Greco-Roman Egypt lists 604 of Homer. That's not including scholia, anthologies, or commentaries. In distant second place is Demosthenes with 83 manuscripts, Euripides 77, Hesiod with 72, and Plato with 42. And we're thinking, okay, Plato has 42 manuscripts, and Homer has 604. You realize that Homer that's the elephant in the room. And this is one of the first books that actually, in serious detail, deals with the figure of Jesus in the context of the single most popular bit of fiction, or, you know, most popular bit of literature in the world at the time. And it's amazing how so many people just don't even think about that. You know, they don't even look at where media comes, or look at the, I was going to say the media landscape, but look at the entertainment landscape, look at the landscape that was there culturally when the work was made. I find this thing fascinating. This is a whole 200 pages talking about this stuff. So if you're into the Bible or into history or literature or ancient history or the Odyssey or anything like this, I think this is a really, really interesting book. So
does sound fascinating. Yeah. And I, like Jenny, I've heard things too where, you know, you hear a speaker or somebody say, yeah, and he would have been expected to do this, and yet he did this. Yeah. And that's interesting. Yeah. So was Mark somebody, I mean, was it an oral tradition throughout, you know, the beginning of the Christian church? Was he telling stories like that, or?
Well, this is the thing. That's what debate is about. The thing, weirdly enough, I mean, this is a huge topic, but the very, very short version is that pretty much all scholarship about the Bible, or the 99.9999% of scholarship by the Bible is written about by Christians or from people working within the Christian worldview, and more importantly, people working within the world, within the universities and the centers of study who pay them. Also Christian, I wouldn't say conservative Christian, but just Christian based, if you know what I mean. So what happens is that anybody who comes out and says, actually, Jesus was probably a mythical figure, he wasn't actually a historical figure, those people don't have jobs for very long. So what happens is in these books, like this book with Dennis R. McDonald, this is 200 pages of him saying pretty much everything that we read about in this whole book is all... Is all fiction. It's all based on fiction. It's all transvaluation of existing fiction. And then at the very end, like three paragraphs before the end of the conclusion, he suddenly says, and by this, we can now have a deeper understanding of the tradition of Jesus and find out who he really was as a real person. And you're just like, wow, that's your little, I still want to have my job. I'm not saying that, I'm not saying that he doesn't believe that Jesus didn't exist or did exist or there was existing oral tradition about Jesus at the time. But the weird thing is like every book that's written about it, or so many of these books that's written about Jesus, explains everything away that there's literally no way to know if Jesus was a real person. And if he was, there's no way to know what was told about him before what we have in the Gospels. The Gospels were so free as literary works of literature, even among themselves, you know, there's so many contradictions between them that it's literally impossible to know what was there before the Gospels about Jesus, as a human figure on earth. So that's hopefully a long answer, but a lot shorter answer than it could have been about that. Actually, the introduction that I'm going to read for the next book, which is similar kind of topic, but it'll kind of clear some of that up as well, I think. Hopefully, we'll see how it goes.
Okay.
So anyway, there's book number one. A bit different from my normal science fiction book review podcast.
I know. This will be great.
All right, Jenny, what have you got?
Well, it's funny because this is related to an old episode of Reading Envy 2. When Jason was on, I think it was episode 14,
gentleman?
Yes. He talked about an author, Paul Yoon. Mm-hmm. And in passing, he mentioned Paul's wife, Laura Vandenberg, who's also an author, and mentioned that he liked her. And I ended up reading a novel by her. It's a galley. It doesn't come out till February. So I didn't want to talk about that because I couldn't really read an excerpt since it's not final copy. It was called Find Me, and I liked it so much I went out and found a different book of hers. The other books that she's written are books of short stories. So I brought What the World Will Look Like When All the Water Leaves Us. It's a set of short stories. They are all very dark. there's a lot of death, a lot of illness, a lot of people who are alone, a lot of parents who are scientists for some reason. I don't know if that's something that comes from the author's life or just something she's interested in. And they're set in all different places. There's one in, I think, Uganda, one in the tropical area, one near the Amazon. So it was really interesting reading. What else should I say about her? Oh, I think the dark and depressing thing is great because, you know, I like that anyway. But her novel that she ended up writing is post-apocalyptic. So it's
win-win.
Even better.
Is that the novel that's coming out in the future, or is that one that you've read already?
Yeah, in February. Okay. But I have already read it. I got an advanced copy of it. It's her first. So the story I'm going to read a little from is the very first one in the book, and it's from the very first few pages of it. It's called Where We Must Be, and it is about a woman who works as Bigfoot at a Bigfoot park. So here we go. Today, I'm going after a woman from Albuquerque. She's small and sharp-shouldered, dressed in khaki shorts and a pink sweatshirt. I'd be willing to bet no one knows she's here. For a brief time, this woman will be living in another world where all that matters is escaping Bigfoot. People say the park is great for realigning their priorities, for reminding them that survival is an active choice. I'm watching her from behind a dense cluster of bushes. The fat man has informed me that she wants to be ambushed. This isn't surprising. Most people crave the shock. My breath is warm inside the costume. The rubber has a faintly sweet smell. I like to stroke my arms and listen to the swishing sound of the fake fur. The mask has eye holes but blocks my peripheral vision, so I can only see straight ahead. The fat man says this is an unexpected benefit of not having more advanced masks. According to him, Bigfoot is a primitive creature, not wily like extraterrestrials or the Loch Ness Monster, and only responds to what's directly in front of him. Two other people work at the park, Jeffrey and Mac, but our shifts never overlap. The fat man thinks it's important for us to not see our counterparts in person, to believe we are the only Bigfoot. I wait for the woman to relax, watching for the instant when she begins to think, maybe there won't be a monster after all. I can always tell when this thought arrives. First, their posture softens. Then their expression changes from confused to relieved to disappointed. More than anything, the ambush is about waiting the customer out. I struggle to stay in character during those quiet moments. It's tempting to consider my own life and worries, but when the time comes to attack, it will only be believable if I've been living with Bigfoot's loneliness and desires for at least an hour. The woman yawns and rubs her cheek. She bends over and scratches her knee. She stops looking around the forest. Her expectations are changing. She checks her watch. I start counting backwards from 10. When I reach 0, I pound into the clearing and release the first roar, a piercing animal sound still foreign to my ears. I liked that one.
That is pretty cool.
Is that the full story?
No, it goes on from there.
Oh, I was going to say, quick question. Are Bigfoot parks where Bigfoot impersonators go, and is that a thing, or is that just in the book thing? I literally have no idea. I just flew over from Berlin today, so I don't know.
It sounds like a very American thing to have, but I've never heard of them.
Yeah, I've never heard of one either, but it wouldn't surprise me a bit.
Okay. Maybe I should Google that later to see if it's there or not.
Yeah,
and later in the story, a guy pays extra to kill a Bigfoot.
Okay, now I see why you said these are dark stories.
Dark.
Yeah.
And a woman playing a Bigfoot. She was the first one, you know, because most of the time you would expect a man to play Bigfoot.
But if you're in a Bigfoot costume, I guess you can't tell very well, can you? I don't know.
Yeah, how you walk would be important, and the roar you would make.
The roar, but I don't know. We'll see.
I mean, I guess if Bigfoot lives forever, there would need to be female Bigfoots, right? Big feet.
Big feet.
Proud foot. Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah, so there's a lot of questions that you never would have thought about, and they come up in these stories.
Yeah. No, I do. I just opened the Goodreads blurb here as well. So the failed actress takes a job as a Bigfoot impersonator. A grieving missionary becomes obsessed with a creature rumored to live in the forests of the Congo. Mm-hmm. This is It seems like lots of connection with the Earth as well. Like, this is the title story. A young woman traveling with a scientist mother in Madagascar confronts her burgeoning sexuality and her dream of becoming a long-distance swimmer. So, yeah, it feels very rooted in, I don't know, creatures and forest and...
Monsters.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, monsters, I guess, as well. So I don't know anything about the book, but just from those little ideas, it seems pretty interesting.
Yeah, I really liked it. And I think this might be her first one.
Would you consider her a Southern writer?
Well, she's from Florida,
okay.
And we don't really count Florida as Southern.
I've heard that before. No Florida counts, right? Because it's...
You've mentioned Southern, because I do listen to this podcast, you've mentioned this Southern fiction. You had a whole episode about Southern fiction many times. Is there a geographical region for that? Or is it just... Or is it just people with Southern accents who write and read them? I wasn't quite sure exactly how it comes where Southern is in terms of literature.
Well, I think a lot of Southern writers don't want to be considered Southern. So I think to be considered Southern, you probably need to be writing about Southern things, maybe with, you know, characters.
But not Florida.
Yeah, Florida doesn't count. So it would be like Louisiana some of the time, Mississippi, Alabama, the Carolinas, Tennessee, possibly Virginia, possibly Kentucky.
What about the panhandle of Florida? What about the north bit? Maybe not all the way down at the bottom end, but you know. No? Okay.
No,
it's
Florida's
just all renegades and retirees down there, so.
Okay.
And Texas is in a way too, right?
Yeah, Texas isn't Southern. Nope. There's some great writers that come out of Florida. I just wouldn't call them Southern.
Okay.
That's
this one doesn't
general.
Have any zombies in it, though.
Yeah, no zombies. And the monsters that are in there are rarely actually seen. But people in the stories believe they exist.
Okay.
Because there is a story that is at Lake Inverness. Is that how you say it? Where the Loch Ness monster is.
We call it Lake Ness, but it's near Inverness.
Oh, okay. Lake Ness.
Hmm. Ness.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Loch Ness.
Loch Ness, of course. Loch Ness. Oh, how could I forget that? That's obvious.
Near, yes, Inverness is, yeah, you go left a bit. And you're left.
Well, that makes sense. Loch Ness near Inverness. Just never thought about it.
Yeah.
But the woman in that story is actually looking for a very specific flower, and she runs into people who are looking for the Loch Ness monster.
And she's not interested in the monster.
Well, I think it kind of actually ruins looking for flowers for her.
Oh.
Yeah, not nearly as exciting.
I've never been to Loch Ness. I've actually been to Inverness, and there's a place where a cruise ship goes nearby there, and everyone goes off and looks at Loch Ness, and everyone comes back saying, it's a lake.
Yeah.
Well, it's not a lake. It's like a loch or fjord kind of thing, and one day I'll see it.
You should.
Mm-hmm.
What's that? Juliana says there's some pretty castles around the Loch Ness. But,
That's nice.
Yes, there's one I can't pronounce that starts with a U near there.
So, Jenny, you read a lot of short story collections, do you?
I don't know that I do that intentionally, but a lot of times when there's an author that's just starting to get written about, it seems to be that they're publishing short stories first, which I suppose makes sense.
Yeah, because it seems like on this one, you're often talking about, oh, this person's got a new novel out. Beforehand, he only had a short story collection, but now here's his first novel or her first novel. That seems to come up quite a lot in these. I know, just maybe it's just this podcast, or maybe it's just that's what happens more. And I generally don't do a lot of short story collections. A few of them. I'm halfway through her Smoke Rose Up Forever. James Triptree Jr., which is there's some fun stories in there. I just don't think I'm a cut out for short story collections. It always annoys me. Mm-hmm. I start off and then I get to the end of a short story and I'm like, no more of that. But then with this Beggars in Spain, I was like, no more. And carried on. So.
Well, and I guess that's the good side of it is if you don't like it, it's over sooner.
Mm-hmm.
Well, with Beggars in Spain, I thought, like, I got to this point, I was just like, I'm just not going to finish this book. And then when I did some research, I realized, oh, I've actually just read the first novella, like the original novella, Beggars in Spain, which was a Hugo Award winning book. It won the Hugo and Nebula Awards, the novella did. And it turns out I read that, I completed that, but I didn't complete the novel. So at least I got completed a unit of fiction. And I think it was a satisfying unit of fiction, but there was still another 10 hours of the audiobook that I didn't get through.
Yeah. You know, I do think it's rare for an author to only write short stories, but there are a few people I can think of that's what they're better known for. And their names are both George. So George Singleton, who's a Southern writer, and George Saunders, who's a New Yorker. But they're the only two I can think of that's really what they write.
And they can make a living from that?
I think they probably pick up some teaching jobs along the way.
Yeah.
It's a hard one.
Yeah, for sure.
Cool.
Yeah. No question that would be hard.
Yep. Anything more about Laura Van Den Burg? We kind of steered that conversation into short
story. Okay. Maybe it's time for Scott then.
All right.
Oh, okay.
Well, yeah, well, I knew you were coming on the podcast, and you just talked about Hugulers, which is a series I had enjoyed quite a bit. So I thought I'm going to read a Hugular and talk about it today. I looked at the novella stack, and there's probably about, I don't know, 13, 14 or so that have won both in the novella category.
Like Beggars in Spain.
Yeah, like Beggars in Spain, exactly. So I read Ill Met in Lankmar by Fritz Leiber, which is one that I hadn't read before. I'd read several of the others, but I thought I'd read one that I hadn't read before. I actually listened to it on the plane. It was read by Jonathan Davis, and it's available on Audible. But unfortunately, I didn't think it was fantastic. But in 1971, it won the Hugo and the Nebula Award. It's the same year that Ringworld won both for the best novel. And it is held up as a really early, very popular example of sword and sorcery, which is currently an extremely popular genre that, you know, Brandon Sanderson and et cetera, kind of a Dungeons and Dragons type of story, thieves, beggars, magicians, that kind of stuff. But it stars two people. They're called Fafhrd, F-A-F-H-R-D, and the Grey Mouser, who are... It's like a buddy movie kind of, but this story, as I understand it, is kind of a prequel. So Leiber published a few of these, and then he did this prequel where they first met, and then it won both awards. Was published in the Fantasy and Science Fiction magazine in April of 1970. After I read it, you know, this is not the first Fritz Leiber I've read, but you know, there are some authors that you just can't connect with. And I think he's the one of them for me, because I've read The Big Time, which was a Hugo winner. I think it was the first Hugo winning novel. And, you know, I really didn't connect with it either. And then, now this one. So I'm wondering if he's just going to be lost on me, but it was interesting nonetheless. Just not fantastic. So I've got just a snippet here to read. It's again, you know, there's Thieves Guild at the very beginning of the story. There are these two thieves who have stolen gems, and the two thieves that have stolen these gems are not Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser. But Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser both separately decide to steal these gems from these two thieves at the same moment. And that's how they meet. So here's an example of the prose. So what's happening is the Grey Mouser is above one of these thieves that is, running away, knowing that he's about to get his precious gems stolen. And I'll start right there. The Grey Mouser turned round in the right-hand niche, leaped up and caught hold of the cornice, silently vaulted to the flat roof, and crossed it precisely in time to see the two thieves emerge below. Without hesitation, he leaped forward and down, his body straight as a crossbow bolt, the soles of his rat-skin boots aimed at the shorter thief's fat buried shoulder blades, though leading him a little to allow for the yard he'd walk while the Mouser hurtled toward him. In the instant that he leaped, the tall thief glanced up over shoulder and whipped out a knife, though making no move to push or pull Fissif, who's one of the thieves, out of the way of the human projectile speeding toward him. More swiftly than one would have thought he could manage, Fissif whirled round then and thinly screamed, "Slivikin!" The ratskin boots took him high in the belly. It was like landing on a big cushion. Riding aside from Slavas's thrust, the Mouser somersaulted forward, and as the fat thief's skull hit a cobble with a dull bang, he came to his feet with dirk in hand, ready to take on the tall one. But there was no need. And that's when Fafhrd shows up, too. So it's like that throughout. And there's really three events that occur in the story. These two guys meeting, and then one of their girlfriends talks him into infiltrating the Thieves Guild. And while they're gone, their girlfriends are killed by a, quote, fast-moving evil witch beast, which is sent by the Thieves Guild because they stole these gems they were getting back at them. And then the third event is that they return to the Thieves Guild to kick some butt after they killed their girlfriends. So, but I'm a little perplexed as to what the... you know, this is a beloved series by Fritz Leiber. This is only one novella in several books worth of things, starring these two, Fafford and the Grey Mouser. But I guess, you know, I don't plan to read any farther. But
well, that's the thing with these voted awards. Once a series gets lots of fans, that series gets lots of votes. Uh-huh. See Vorkosigan Saga.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Vorkosigan continues to win. But yeah. So looking
nominated
through this
anyway.
Yeah. Through this novella Hugular list, The Persistence of Vision by John Varley is fantastic. I could recommend a few of these. But, you know,
Persistence of Vision has been recommended to me. I think I tried getting an audio version, but it was difficult and I was having to like torrent it and stuff like that. So, and it didn't, and no torrents were available, or what do you call it? No cedars or something anyway.
Yeah.
But thing I is, Persistence of Vision has been recommended to me many, many times by listeners of the SFBRP. Nobody mentioned that it won a Hugo and Nebula. And I think what it comes down to is that you listen to my series, but Jenny was saying this, like, oh, I read all the books on an awards list, or it's a good way to find books. I found it isn't. The good books will be on those lists, but they'll be recommended to you despite those lists, if that makes sense. So
good
book, it's certainly if this is a book. When did this book come out? This is, you say, from 1970 or something?
1970.
Oh, this was 1970.
Yep.
Oh yeah, Big Time was from the 50s.
Right.
If a book is still being talked about now, it's worth reading. If it's not being talked about and yet it still won awards back in the 1970s, might not be good.
Yeah, when I saw it, I was like, yeah, let me try that one, because it does show up elsewhere. Amongst real fantasy fans. Yeah. And I think that, you know, fantasy fans talk about it kind of in the same way they talk about Conan and things like that. It's just kind of a founding, you know, founding documents of fantasy, and this would be kind of like a middle age document, I guess. The earlier ones being Conan.
It reminded me, there was with the thieves and the swordsman and the thieves guilds. Have you read The Lies of Loch Lamara and that series?
No,
by
I
Scott
haven't.
Lynch?
I have not.
It's that now that you, that bit that you just read out could literally have just come from that book. So I can kind of see, like you say, this is a founding document of this sword and sorcery kind of wizards and thieves and different guilds in a city, and then getting and then killing each other and killing killing people because they stole a jewel that was meant to be ours. That is the basis of The Lies of Loch Lamara and the follow-up book, which was, I think, Red Seas Under Red Skies.
Yeah.
Sounds very influential.
Right. So yeah, even though I didn't like it a heck of a lot, you know, I'm always happy to have read some of these things because
Big Time.
You know,
I didn't think I knew that one, and then when you mentioned it, I looked it up on Wikipedia because you said that won a Hugo Award. It turns out I have actually read it. With the two factions, both capable of time travel, engaged in a long-term war with each other. Their method of battle involves changing the outcomes of the events throughout history. So they go back in time and change things, and it's like a constant battle between two sides of changing their own futures to make things come out. Oh, the change in the past to change the future, that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
And I do remember reading that. I mean, I remember having read it, but only after you mentioned it and I looked it up on Wikipedia.
Yeah, cool.
What do you think, Jenny? Sword and sorcery, your kind of thing?
Never.
It's not really my kind of thing. No?
Has never been and never will be.
Because you were silent through that entire discussion.
Oh, yeah. Well, I've tried some of these more recent books that have the same kind of theme, you know, where books that people just love them and they think they're so great. And I just,
they're not very good.
I just don't care enough. I don't know what it is. I mean, I have read, I like The Name of the Wind, or In the Name of the Wind.
See, I don't even think that's a good example. I mean, it's very popular and it was enjoyable enough. But it's all fluff. And that was a lot of fluff to get through. That was hours and hours. I mean, a really big book and hours of audiobook of fluff.
Oh, yeah. An audio, that would be long.
And I just want, I wouldn't have done it if I'd have had to read the words themselves. I wouldn't have got through it. Certainly not the second book.
What about, what about,
I thought it was going in an interesting direction. It's just fluff.
What about Sanderson's, what do they call them, the Stormbringer archive?
I haven't tried those.
Yeah, I mean to, but I have not read those two. But
Two-thirds of Way of Kings was really, really good. The other third, one of the characters, just wasn't interesting and it kind of disconnected from the story of the other two. So if you're going to do it, just skip all of the chapters which... all of the sections which aren't taking place on the Broken Plains. Read the Broken Plains chapters, but when it goes back to the woman reading about... Anyway, I said that, but then the next one comes out and people say, oh no, you actually have to read her section of the story now. And I'm like, oh, I might not do that.
So you haven't,
it is more closely tied.
Yeah. You haven't read the second one.
I mean, it's on my Audible wish list, but it is just really big and chunky.
Yeah.
But it's one of those series that you think, well, I'll get in on the series at the start. You know, this is a bit too. You know, it's gonna take 10 years, 15 years to finish off. You know, to actually be written and be put out, because it's, you know, projected to be like 8 or 10 books long or something, and each of them are going to be this big.
Yeah.
So if I don't keep up with it, I'm not gonna catch up later.
he's a local Utah writer, so I mean, I get those mentioned to me all the time. You know, you should read these. You should read. So those two would have to. Those are the most recommended to me, I would say, at least in person.
Wow.
Not over the internet, but
I would
in
say
person.
He does have some other books which are shorter and slightly more accessible. And again, they are fluff. I think The Warbreaker is slightly less fluffy. But if you want to read the first Mistborn one, is perfectly good. You know, it's like very Fritz Lieber's Ilmettert Lankmar again. It's like magic and the magic and the thieves, and it's a bit dystopian, post-apocalyptic kind of stuff going on there, but in a fantasy setting. But
and it's
very clever. That book is actually cleverer than you think it is. Like in the last chapter, you go, oh, all this time it was a different kind of book than I expected.
Oh, cool.
Which can
sometimes that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
You can buy Fritz Lieber's Ilmettert Lankmar for 19 cents for a used hard copy.
Perfect.
There you go.
Yeah. Cool. All right, Luke. Well, what's up next? We're going to Rome, right?
Oh, yeah. Let's go to Rome. Let's go home to Rome. So this book is by someone called Michael Peppard. And this is the Oxford University Press. The other one was Yale. This is Oxford University Press. But again, you get it secondhand for like $15 or something. It's called The Son of God in the Roman World, Divine Sonship in its Social and Political Context, which makes you already want to fall asleep. But let me read out the preface, not the introduction, the preface. Here we go. Imagine yourself in the first century, a Jewish resident of the burgeoning Roman Empire. Perhaps you live in Rome itself, the Eternal City, or perhaps you live in Alexandria, the other bastion of high culture around the Mediterranean. If you live in Jerusalem, your perspective is slightly different, as the Roman military presses in on you from all sides. From there, it seems like the world is about to end. Regardless of exactly where you live, you have a different perspective on the cosmos, a different worldview than that of a modern Western person. You are not an autonomous individual with guaranteed liberties, but your entire life transpires as the subject of an empire. You have never actually seen your emperor, but you know a great deal about him. You've heard stories about him from everyone, about what he says and does, about what his childhood was like, about his many triumphs. You know his face from coins and the faces of his whole family from statues. You know them almost as well as your own. In fact, in this era before mirrors in every room, you probably know his face better than your own. He is the most famous, the most powerful person in the world. But there is something else. also, oh, sorry, there is someone else also whom you've never seen that you know even better than the emperor. You first heard of Jesus from people who actually did know him. They told you all kinds of stories about him, too many to remember, accounts of what he said and did about his tragic end and his glorious appearing. You believe the stories, they give you life, and you want to share those stories with as many people as you can. You decide to write a narrative. But where do you begin? You don't know about his childhood or what he looked like. You met his brother once. Maybe he looked a bit like him. Then again, you think of yourself also as his brother. Those who knew him passed on his chief teachings, and they proclaimed him as the Son of God. He prayed to his father and inaugurated a new family of God. You believe this and you live by it, but believing and living are different than narrating. Again, so where do you begin? The one main problem you have as a Jew with portraying God's son is that your God does not have a partner. For this reason, among others, your God is unusual in the Roman world. But if the paternal God does not procreate, how do you portray the divine sonship of Jesus? Again, where do you begin? Put yourself in Mark's shoes. How do you narrate the life of God's son? So that's the preface of it, and then it goes on to talk about sons of God and who was the original person who called himself the Son of God. Turns out it was Julius Caesar's adopted son, Octavius. And so he was the Son of God because he was the Son of God in two different ways. He was said to be his mother was visited by Apollo and became pregnant via Apollo, and he was the Son of God in that way, but also he was adopted by Julius Caesar without his knowledge, but in his will, in Julius Caesar's will, it turns out he had adopted him, and that was his claim on the Roman Empire, or as the, you know, as the head of the Roman Empire above Anthony. And so, yeah, and that's the kind of thing. So this whole book lays out what we all know intellectually about how Roman, like the Caesars, passed on, like who became the next Caesar. It wasn't the son, always the biological son. It was just as often, if not more often, early on, it was much more often that it would be the adopted son. And it was actually the adopted son who was more important than the begotten son. The son who was made was more important than the son who was begotten. The one who was made into the son was more important than the one who was born as the son. And so it really throws into stark relief what the difference is, first of all, between the different gospels, but later on all these different councils of Nicaea and the whole he was begotten, not made, was this massive sticking point about who Jesus was and how he was the Son of God. And this book really throws it into perspective, not just that, but just all of the social, like say, the social stuff, the political stuff, the religion stuff, just how important emperor worship was in the Roman world, even across what is the modern day Israel, Palestine, all of that area, Jerusalem. It was just a massive part. So yeah, that's the other way of looking at this, not from the Greek literary point of view, but like, was Jesus's character influenced by the emperor and the way that emperors were, the lineage of the emperor, and what the term the Son of God actually, where it comes from, and what it would mean to the people in the first century Roman world if they heard Jesus was the Son of God. What would that mean to them? Not what it means to us now in the Western world, but what would it mean to those people then? So again, yeah, a very fascinating book,
which is really important. It looks like from the description he uses the Gospel of Mark as well, huh? Is that Mark?
Oh yeah, both of these books are almost purely about the Gospel of Mark. That's what their focus is, and like you say, that's where it starts. Because once you start there, like, you can't say anything about what the original people thought about Jesus or about the stories about Jesus without first seeing what Mark says about them. You literally can't take Matthew's word for it, or John's word for it, or Luke's word for it in any way at all, because they were written for different audiences, for different theological reasons, and for different, to make Jesus into a different character. There's a reason why at the beginning of Mark there is no nativity. It's because for Mark the most important thing was the imagery of Jesus being adopted by God. He's saying, this is my son, in whom I'm well pleased. And a dove came down from heaven and landed on his shoulder. You know, this is, or lighted on him. You know, that is the image that he wanted, because it turns out that at that time, in the first century, more so in the second century, where some people think Mark was written, the place that was famous for adoptions of emperors was beside rivers, and he put it beside the Jordan. And then there's always the legend that when this person, I think it was Trajan, was it Hadrian? I'm thinking back a few months since I last read this section, but I think it was Trajan, when he was adopted by Hadrian, an eagle flew down and gave him something. You know, but so the idea even of birds coming down from heaven alighting on someone at their adoption was a portentous sign from the gods that this was a correct thing, you know. So the location, the imagery, the symbolism, and the act is right out of what was the single most important thing, event, outside of a new emperor being crowned, was the emperor saying who was adopted or adopting his son. So when he died, that would be the next thing coming up. Of course, we know that from the movie. Have you seen the movie Gladiator? Have you seen that one?
I haven't.
You have? You haven't. Jenny hasn't seen anything, I don't think, or read anything. I'm not sure. Anyway, but at the beginning of that, Marcus Aurelius is saying to, is it Maximus? He's saying, yes, you are going to become my son. You're going to become the new emperor. And the whole drama starts off when Commodus finds out about this and is like, no, I'm going to be the new emperor. But, you know, even that acknowledges that even, well, that was in the third century, second, third, fourth century, that even then the idea of adopted sonship being more important than biological sonship. Yeah. So Mark and Luke disagreed with this. They wanted Jesus to be God's biological son. So they did what was always done in that time, which was a god visits a maiden and gets, you know, impregnates her, and that's it. You know, exactly like Octavius and lots of these other emperors. Oh, yes, my mother was visited by this, you know, and that's how it worked out. And then John takes it even further and says, oh, I don't need a nativity, because who impregnated Mary, why Mary, who the father of Jesus was biologically, doesn't matter at all, because Jesus is the pre-existing son of God since before the creation of the world. He goes all the way back to, in the beginning there was the word, and you're like, whoa, what about the nativity? No, it doesn't matter to John, and the nativity doesn't matter to Mark. So you can actually see the evolution of the story of Jesus as you go through. First Mark was written, and then Luke and Matthew were written, and then John was written last, you know. No, you know, like building on these earlier stories, but changing them, like transvaluating them in ways that suited them better for spiritual reasons and teaching reasons and just storytelling reasons. You know, a lot of the changes in Luke and Matthew, you can see they just had a different story that they wanted to tell, or a different focus in the stories. And they're like, well, I'll just change this character. Oh, this can be a different group of people that he's talking to here. And it's the same words, but he just happens to be with a different audience. And things. So yeah, Son of God in the Roman World by Michael Peppard is my second book. Any questions?
Right. Well, I think I might see Gladiator if you promise me that Russell Crowe doesn't sing.
I don't think he sings. You didn't like Les Mis?
Oh, I love Les Mis, except for every moment where he was singing.
To be honest, I think Hugh Jackman did not... He was a better singer, but did a worse job. Because I think that the main role... It needs like just a bigger voice, and he was always kind of like whispering and like this. And I just want, no, you need, like, for me, that's the starring role, and I think he did a bad job. Russell Crowe, I knew he was going to be bad, so I wasn't disappointed. I was just like, well, that was him. Anyway,
that's funny. I was listening to that just this morning. Not that version. No, okay. The 25th anniversary concert version.
That's my favorite as well. It's in total on YouTube. You can watch it in 10 parts or 8 parts on YouTube. It's really impressive. And then at the end, they bring out lots of Jean Valjeans from around the world, and they sing in different languages as well, which is a fun ending to that.
Very cool.
Too. So
it's very neat.
Yeah. All right.
Okay.
Cool. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Nerdy history books about the Bible.
Fascinating.
But history books. It's not. The thing is, you could read these having never read Mark, and these will make a lot of sense to you just because you know the stories of Jesus already, and you're like, well, where does that come from? Why is that in there? Oh yeah, one other thing. This is again. He says, oh, you. This like the preface there was saying, oh, you knew Jesus, or you knew people who knew Jesus. It's funny that if you actually take both of these books, by the end of them, they both say, now knowing this, we can get a better view of what Jesus is. But taking them together, like, there's not a lot else in Mark which isn't explained by the Roman history at the time, or the Roman influence at the time, or the Odyssey, or the Old Testament, the Septuagint, Greek Old Testament.
In some way, though, doesn't it make sense that, you know, if you wanted to communicate something to a people, you're going to use something that they're familiar with?
Yeah, of course.
You know, like if we wanted to communicate something, you know, we may write a book or make a movie, you know, but we're not operating in a vacuum where we're influenced by everything we've read and seen.
Exactly. Yeah. That is exactly right. And the thing, and this is the biggest case for, you know, the mythicist view of Jesus is that these books, what Mark did is he created something which was more popular, so much more popular than it was more popular than what had gone before. For example, now when we watch Star Wars, the original Star Wars, we don't realize that all of those shots were taken from previous movies and influenced from here. You know, people go through and do a shot-by-shot comparison of, you know, this movie, this Second World War movie, and these other samurai movies, you know, and all these other things. Is it The Fortress? No, The Two Fortresses or whatever it's called. There's all these different movies that people say, oh, this shot's from there, and this story's from there, and that character's from there, and this character's from there. But Star Wars is bigger than everything that came before it. So now we just see Star Wars as, like, the model.
Right.
And that's kind of what happened with the Gospel of Mark. Everything that had gone beforehand was a model. You know, like, he based it on there. But now when we know Jesus, we only know Mark's story. We don't know what people thought of anything beforehand, because Mark was so, his gospel was so massive and so influential that it's like almost impossible to go back before that and read you can read the letters of Paul, like the epistles of Paul, which were written before Mark, but it's very difficult to unsee what Mark thought about Jesus. When you read about Jesus in there, you go, oh yes, of course, this is referring to this thing in Jesus' life. In fact, it's the other way around. Mark was teaching, like taking what's in Paul's letters and the other teaching of Jesus at the time, and he created something bigger than them. And of course, they arrange after that in any New Testament. The letters come after the Gospels. So you read the Gospels through, so you get Mark's view of it and these other Gospel writers' view, and then you read the letters, the epistles, and you're like, well, that matches up with there, and that matches up with there, that matches up with there. But that's like going back to the Hidden Fortress and going, well, this scene, that's that scene in Star Wars, and that's that scene in that Star Wars. And you should know it's actually the other way around.
if that
makes sense.
Yeah, sure.
Well, and I think it's a nice pairing, though, because if you just had the letters, it would feel more didactic. But if you have the letters paired with the story...
Yeah. Well, what Mark did, he's gone, well, we know this is what we need to tell churches. Like, what's in the letters we need to tell churches? That's what Paul was telling people. So I'm going to, you know, even if Jesus said these, or if Jesus existed, or if Jesus didn't exist, it's like almost impossible to know. But we only know that Jesus said these things because Mark told us he said them. Paul never mentions that Jesus did any teaching at all. Paul never mentions that Jesus told anyone anything or gave any teaching anything. All of the teaching is from his own pen. He says it's inspired by God, but he says that God has told him directly, or Jesus came down from heaven to tell him, not that Jesus told people on earth. So the teaching is pre-existing teaching. The character of Jesus is pre-existing character. And Mark put them together into the Gospel of Mark in a way that, which was just revolutionary. And I think, personally, my own opinion is that's what kickstarted Christianity in the first place. So there you go. Kickstarted Christianity as we know it, like modern Christianity. And I say modern as in from the second century onwards.
Very interesting, yeah. Cool.
Okay, well, there you go.
All right.
Thank you.
All right, Jenny.
So there's two books to start off
with. Excellent.
Two books. Well, for my last book, yesterday, we're recording on a Friday, and yesterday was Thanksgiving in the United States, and so I decided to finally pick up this book I've been meaning to read for a long time. It's called As They Were by M.F.K. Fisher. M.F.K. Fisher, I think that's Mary Frances Kennedy Fisher, is a very well-known food writer, but she's also a very literary She's published in places like The New Yorker, Atlantic Monthly, things like that when she was alive. In fact, there's even an award named after her for female culinary writer of literary merit. And so this book, As They Were, is actually a collected book of essays that span from the 1940s to the 1980s. And she has written prefaces to each one, kind of putting them in context, explaining more about them, maybe why she made some of the decisions she made, because some of the time she changes the details and some of the time it's just straight story from her actual life. I kind of call it nostalgia food writing, but it is very well written, which makes a really big difference. And you know, I've been taking that creative nonfiction class this semester, so I find myself reading more essays. I would never have read essays before, and I'm kind of discovering, wow, there's a lot of great stuff out there that I've been kind of ignoring, basically. And one of the essays I've been working on my own has to do with restaurants, so it's nice to read that kind of thing and see how people write about it. So I guess some of my favorite essays, there's one called I Was Really Very Hungry. And it's about when she went to this restaurant in Northern Burgundy and she ended up with this waitress who was kind of manic and just insisted on feeding her this amazing food. There's a story of her first visit to a fine restaurant when she was six. There's one called About Looking Alone at a Place, where she was by herself in Arles, France, in the off season, where no one was expecting to have any tourists around. And it's really kind of interesting. A lot of the stories have to do with before World War II. So Europe was very different then and food was very different then. So I don't know. I felt like I was really being transported to a place. The one I'm going to read a little bit from is called Two Kitchens in Provence. And it's basically she picked up and moved her family to France. And they lived in two different houses with two different kinds of kitchens. So this one is the very end of the first kitchen. By the way, I'm reading from a book that's ancient and falling apart. So page 101 is currently the first page that's still inside the cover. With the mistral surging and leaning against the windows, and the chestnut trees and the red poppies in the meadows, and the spiritual food a part of the whole, we would eat at breakfast canned grapefruit juice, large bowls of café au lait with brown sugar, slices of Dijon gingerbread with sweet butter and alpine honey, at noontime whole new potatoes boiled in their jackets in a big pot of carrots, onions, sausage, which we'd eat later, sweet butter, mild cheese, and a bowl of green olives and little radishes. Then for supper, the vegetable broth with a sausage cut in thin rings, the whole new carrots and onions drained and tossed with a little butter and chopped parsley and celery tops from the farmer's garden, and a bowl of three cans mixed together of peaches, pears, pineapple. The next day, there would still be some clear broth, and I would make a jelly from the fruit juices, and I would start over again, probably a big salad, which I would soak in the fountain to rid it of most of the innumerable critters that are considered correct for country produce in Provence, and then a pot of hot small artichokes to eat with melted butter and lemon juice, and sliced tomatoes that had lasted 2 days after marketing instead of only one, because the mistral was blowing, and then maybe soft-boiled eggs from the shepherdess for supper. There was always that little rich decadent tin of lark pâté in the cupboard if I grew bored, or we could stroll down past the great ponds under the plane trees to the deft, friendly welcome of the restaurant Tomé and eat a grilled pullet or a trout marnier and an orange baked à la Norvégienne, sorry for my French, or we could stay home and I would try at last the mayonnaise maker I had bought from the fat man in the market.
Nice.
I feel like both of my readings had fat men in them. It's funny.
did she see any Bigfoots?
No Bigfoots. There's this one story where she rides a freighter, which
the
I feel
Dutch
like
freighter.
Yeah, the Dutch freighter. It's kind of like a certain time and place for sure, and you get to hear words like "Gudsfrites." I don't know Dutch, but
now I understand that before we start recording you were like, how do you pronounce this?
I actually picked the story or the essay that had less of those,
the least spelling.
Wow. Yeah.
I think you said she went to you to Arles. I think it's Arles.
Probably.
The thing is, in French, you always have to like miss off the last letter unless it's a unless it's got another letter after the last letter, and then you say the last letter, but only if it's got a letter after the last letter.
Yeah, it's such a confusing
French is it's a very annoying language. So, Jenny, what is your favorite meal? If you had to write an essay about your favorite food, maybe not the best taste, the favorite food experience that you had, like if you had to add an essay to this, or if you wanted to win her award for excellence in culinary writing, what would be your meal?
I'm sitting here with a horrified look on my face. I don't know. I tend to write about food from the other side, like working in a kitchen and preparing the food. So I would have to write that side of the story, I think.
Well, the best meal you've ever made.
Sure.
Is that what you're... Oh, okay.
It'd be an interesting perspective, I think.
Okay, because this theme is very much like, oh, I went here and this food was good. Oh, and that, and it is very evocative because, like, I reading about food, not always doing, but the travel food aspect, I always find pretty fascinating. Any TV program where it's a travel-y food thing, I'm like, oh, I could just sit and watch that for hours of that TV. It feels like that's what this book is. You know, it's like a travel and food.
Absolutely. And that's definitely what she's known for. And, you know, I wrote a review in Goodreads today about it. And already people are like, oh, I love this writer. This is my favorite book. Or some of these others are my very favorite. So it seems to be something people are very connected to. It's very nostalgic. And actually, the reason I decided to read this is because my professor in the class that I'm taking read to us from an essay that she wrote about her first food memory, which is the scraping of the scum off of new jam. Because I grew up canning every summer with my mother. And so it was very similar kind of experience. So that made me go, oh, well, I need to read about more things like that.
Yeah. I think one of my first food experiences that I really remember is also one of the worst experiences I've ever had in my life, where I went to make myself some orange squash, which is like the diluted orange, and you put the stuff in, like the thing, and then you put water in. And what I didn't know is that my mother had done some grilling, some like chip fat frying stuff, and then you save the oil, and she'd put it into the Robinson's orange juice. She'd put it back into an orange juice bottle and put it underneath, the, you know, under the sink. And I didn't know this. And so, you know, you're looking around, and you know, I'm like 5 years old at the time, 4 years old, and I picked it out, and I poured some in a glass, and I was like, oh, there's some bits in it. Oh, it doesn't matter, you know, because you're just like, I just want to drink. Then you went over, and then I poured the water in to like dilute it down, and then I gulped it, and it was, so I just got a mouthful of stale, cold fat, frying fat stuff.
Awful.
That was, and even to this day, when that kind of like stale fat smell, when the grease has cooled down, and there's that it still to this day is one of the things that just makes me like kind of retch, you know, like it really gets to me. And there's only a few like really, really strong smells. Oh, actually, it doesn't even have to be a strong smell, but like one of those smell memories, you know. What is it they said, that smell is so close to your memory centers or something like that, isn't it? So like smells can trigger memories better than any other sense.
So true.
I totally
agree. It's one of those
that.
Things.
Yeah,
because you know, so, I worked in a chocolate shop when 9/11 happened, so those two things are linked in my head. But maybe my happier, my happier food memory. There was a year my grandfather was in the hospital, and so I went over to my grandma's house to help with all the holiday baking. And we have 22 people in my family, so that's a lot of pies and cookies. And her mixer broke, so we did it all by hand.
Wow!
Completely, you know, with your hands and wooden spoons. And
how old were you then?
I was 12.
12, okay.
Yeah, so I, you know, could actually do stuff on my own too. So that was a great memory. My mother used to tell me it skipped a generation so that she didn't have to bake.
But you do the baking.
Yeah, but it was a bonding thing with my grandma, so that's a good memory.
Yeah,
of course. Very nice.
Scott, have you got a good early food memory or a bad one?
Well, you know, I'm not much of a foodie, but there's one. I went to a really nice restaurant one time. I was taken there by my friend who flew me to Phoenix to help him move some stuff out of his ex-girlfriend's place. So it was an interesting day. So I flew to Phoenix, and then that night we went out to eat at this French restaurant that it was the first experience like that I've ever seen. What's that?
I said, was it the place he used to go with his girlfriend?
Maybe so. Yeah, but that's a good memory though. Yeah.
Actually, Jenny, that reminds me, your story of being in working in a chocolate shop in 9/11 is a weird thing where like something positive is attached to something negative by smell. Mm-hmm. I had it like the opposite experience, or a similar but opposite experience with them when we were traveling me and Juliana, my girlfriend, we were traveling around Africa, and we went to this one thing, and it was a lion breeding place because they were breeding lions to reintroduce them back into the wild. It was like this long project, and so we saw these lions which they would chase across this thing and pounce, like these male lions would pounce on these dead like animals, these guts, you know, it was all the offal and guts of this these animals, and everyone was going, oh, this smells terrible, it smells like these guts laying, smells terrible, and people were like covering up their noses and feeling ill. And I realized that for me it was a really happy smell, because I used to go out shooting rabbits with air guns, and when we'd killed a rabbit we would gut it and like shake the guts out and then swing it around and the guts would fly away, you pull the guts out. And so for me the smell of animal guts was the smell of victory, of accomplishment, of achieving my goals. And I realized that really disgusting smell had so many positive connotations that it was actually a positive smell for me, and I'd never really thought of it in that way until that point. And it's such a Your brain is it's so easy to train your brain for positive inputs and, like, you know, that Pavlovian response, you know, that thing for me. But yeah, it turns out disgusting animal gut smells is a happy, brings back happy memories for me of going out in the country with my air gun and shooting rabbits and being happy. Wow. And active and successful, which is a weird one.
Yeah, it's very amazing.
Nice. Anyway, I should write an essay about that. I don't think that would win me an Excellence in Culinary Writing Award, though.
Well, you never know.
I do know.
Thank you for listening to the Reading Envy podcast. You can find us at readingenvy.com.